Hi, this is Dan Pastorini, and you're listening to The Grilling Truth.
Welcome to the Grilling Truth NFL Legends Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo, a new interactive football app where you get to call what the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo, www.gridironmo.com. I'm your host, as always, for the Legends Show, Mike Goodpaster. Right now, I want to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. You know, I really like doing these Legends shows, and it's been a while since we've been able to do one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last guy that was on our Legends show was what? We had Tim Crumry and Lynn Barney, but those were all daytime interviews you couldn't have to do because you're a sucker and got a real job.
Yeah, it was a bummer to miss that, but I do my best to make time, and I definitely am looking forward to tonight.
All right, our guest today, one of the best running backs of the decade of the 80s, power back, could do everything, could block, could catch the ball out of the backfield, four-time Pro Bowler for the Atlanta Falcons. Help me welcome to the show, William Andrews. How you doing, William?
Hey, good evening, guys. How you guys doing?
Oh, it's great to have you on. Good. Like I said, I think there's no doubt you were one of the best running backs I ever saw, so really excited to get you on. And we got to give a shout-out to Gary Burley for helping get you on. So.
Well, yeah, Gary's a good friend, and I've been knowing him, and we've been buddies for a minute. Played together and against each other when he was at the Bengals. And now he joined us down here in Atlanta for about 3 or 4 years, and we just had a great relationship.
All right, so let's go ahead and get started. How did you get started with the game of football, and who were some of your early influences?
Well, you know, I got started early, you know, at YMCA. It was the Western YMCA down in Thomasville, Georgia. You know, I'm a dirt farmer, South Georgia boy, so we need to do something on the weekends, and, you know, the YMCA was a great start for us because that's where we actually, you know, see who was the best in the neighborhood and that kind of thing. So we would put on scrimmages and that kind of gets different because I lived in the project. So we would put on scrimmages to each project that was in our area, and we'd see who the best players were. And so finally, we started getting organized and went to the YMCA and started putting that all together. So I guess that's where I started my skill set, and then it just kept growing from there.
Well, fast forwarding through, you know, after you got started, obviously you were talented enough to attend college and play in college football. So what made you decide on Auburn?
Well, you know, Auburn offered a lot of you know, first of all, it was a great school, period. And then it offered me a chance to get an education, which my mother wanted. Now, my mother was, she was some kind of woman. She didn't want me to go to, she didn't want me to go too far from home. She didn't want me to go to Atlanta because Georgia Tech was on the scale too. Knew I wasn't going out to California to play at USC and any of those colleges. Knew I wasn't going to LSU because LSU never recruited me. So it came down to Georgia, Auburn, and Georgia Tech. And my mom said, there's no way you're going to Atlanta. It's just too much killing up there. So they cut that out. And then so Georgia, because they wrote a bad article on me because I decided I wasn't going to go there because I just didn't like the coaches at the time. And so they really tried to do me in the papers in terms of me not going to Georgia. And so I wind up at Auburn and had a successful career with two great backs, James Brooks and Joe Cribbs. And so I was right at home with those guys, although I blocked primarily for them, but it was fun to watch them run.
Now, you talked about that a little bit. Auburn became known as running back U for like a 10-year period where they had
right.
It just seemed like one running back after the other that ended up in the NFL. What was it like to play with Joe Cribbs, James Brooks, and what's it like when you hear people talk about running back U and know you were one of the guys that started that?
Well, you know, the thing about the running back U, we was called ABC back there, Andrews, Brooks, and Cribbs. But they were two thoroughbreds. I was the mule in the group, so I had to pull the duty of blocking for both of them. And I tell you, it was fun to block for them, because Joe and James had had the size I had, so I had the blocking skill, because I got that when I came out of high school. I had a coach, James Bryant, that really believed in doing things the right way. So technique was important in how you did it and that kind of thing. And that's one thing that we don't have in our school system now, is the fundamentals of the sport. And that's what we're losing, and that's what we need to get back, because a lot of kids out here getting hurt because they're not trained properly how to take on a block, how to block someone, and then how to do the fundamentals of pass, catching, running, and that kind of thing. Everybody can run, but catching the football and pass blocking and all like that, yeah, they just have lost the fundamentals in that. And I'm working with a group here in Atlanta called Kids and Pros with Buddy Curry and Bobby Butler, and they are really two guys that I respect a lot, because they are really teaching these kids techniques and how to do the thing properly and correctly.
You know, when in your days at Auburn, you got to be a part of one of the best rivalries, the Iron Bowl. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you to play in that game?
Well, you know, now, see, I'm a Georgia boy, right? I enjoyed playing Georgia as opposed to playing Alabama. And all the guys that was from Alabama loved to play Alabama. Now, I participated and gave them everything I had, but it seemed like when I played against Georgia, I turned it up a notch. But at the Iron Bowl, at the time, Barry Krause was playing at Alabama, and he was one of the primary guys I needed to block the whole time, because I was the lead back and the fullback, and he was always on the radar screen. And they was talking about how well he could do this, do that, do this. And I said I made it a personal task of mine and a personal setup that I was going to take care of him, that he wasn't going to get any tackles, because I was going to be on him all day long. And that's what happened. He and I, we had a knockdown drag out the whole day. I got a lot of respect for Barry. He's one hell of a linebacker. He was one hell of a linebacker in college. Also played in the pros at the Colts. And I had a chance to meet him again in the Colts when I was at the Falcons. So we talk about those days all the time when we get together. But he was one heck of a guy that I remember having to always go against. We never beat him, but we came close a few times. But we never edged him out to get a win, but it was fun playing against him.
All right, so we get the 1979 draft day. Everybody knows what it's like now. We love to hear the guys that played in the 60s, 70s tell us about what their draft day experience was. I mean, we had Robert Brazil on one time. He's telling us about riding. riding a motorcycle.
Well, he and I used to go at it too, boy.
Robert was a great football player too.
No question. He's the Oilers.
What was your draft day experience like in 1979? I don't think ESPN was doing draft coverage yet.
No, they were not. They were not. Matter of fact, I don't even remember having a combine to see how good we were, how good we wasn't. But I remember my draft day was uneventful. I mean, I wasn't even home when they called me. And so, you know, the strangest thing about that was, see, originally I was supposed to go to Miami because they traded me. They traded the pick. Miami traded the pick for a trade that Atlanta had with Ralph Ortega. Ralph Ortega went down to Miami. I came to Atlanta, so that's how Atlanta got me in the third round, and I was a third-round B pick. So I wasn't the first one that they wanted in the draft, but turns out that I got back home and I had a message on my answer machine that said, William, this is Tom Bratz. I need you to give me a call. We just drafted you in the third round with the Atlanta Falcons, and we need you to call us. So finally I called them and said, really? Y'all drafted me in the third round? They said, great. I said, okay. So it was pretty uneventful.
Your mom more happy that you were just in Atlanta than anybody else.
Yeah, but see, I wound up in Atlanta anyway. So that worked out really good.
Well, you know, in 1979, your rookie season in the NFL, You know, you made an immediate impact right away, rushing for 167 yards in your debut and getting over 1,000 yards in 15 games for the season. What was it about the Atlanta offense that helped you make the most of your opportunities?
Well, you know, the offense was, before I got there, they always talked about the offense never was cohesive enough to get more than 5 yards in practice and all like that. And I said, that can't be true. I've been watching these guys in practice for a long time. And then when you got the rookies there doing their thing and then the veterans come in, it's a whole different ballgame when they come in. And so I got the opportunity to go against the first defense all the time. And my running style and skills and what I offered to the offense, the offensive linemen say, wow, we've never seen anything like this kid before. And so they really just knuckled down and started blocking for me, and I just started running crazy. And at the time we had Granville as the defense coordinator, and, boy, he used to get so upset at me, man. He used to come and tell me, get out of the drill because I'm messing him up. I said, how am I messing him up, coach? I'm running the way that the offense ought to run, so why am I messing it up? So long story short, my guys – treated me like Walter Payton. They didn't like people hit me, and they didn't want people hit me. And when I told them, I said, look, guys, all I need you to do is stalemate them. I can do everything after that. And that's what they did.
All right, so you get there, your first camp, first season. Was there anybody on the team, teammate or coach, that made your transition a lot easier when you got to Atlanta?
Well, the transition came because of the veterans that were there. They used to tell me, William, keep your eyes open and your mouth shut and you'll be all right. So I took that to heart. I kept my eyes open and my mouth shut because I tell you, it's strange how veterans has a way of pointing out to you roadblocks and all this kind of stuff. And they also show you how to get around the roadblocks and that kind of thing. And that's what these guys provided for me, a roadblock. If there was a roadblock, they would provide me an escape route to get to and that kind of thing. And I really appreciated all the help I got from Wallace Francis, Alfred Jenkins, Jim Mitchell. Jim is deceased now, but Jim offered a lot. I look at Warren Bryant. I look at R.C. Tillman, Jeff Van Note. I look at Mike Ken. And those guys just really offered me, because I was like an interior lineman because I was a fullback. So I did the same thing they did, and I had to make sure that my area was taken care of before I ventured out looking for anything else. And, of course, my good buddy Lynn Kane, which added up the other part of what we did, and so he blocked for me, I blocked for him, and we just made the most of every opportunity we got. And it was great to have him and great to have all those guys around me at the time I was playing.
Well, you know, 1980 was a real special season, obviously, for you personally and for the team, for the Atlanta Falcons. Go 12-4, ride a 9-game winning streak after starting 3-3. What was it that made that team so special?
Well, I think we started believing in each other a lot more. And then we took the responsibilities for our areas. We didn't try to go outside of the box in terms of what we needed to do for the guys that was in front of us. We took care of our areas, and that's what we handled. And I think from that, everything gelled from that. Barkowski got a lot more confident in his pass rushing in pass protection that he never did get hit. And the one thing that he takes pride in, even to this day, that when we played tough linebackers like Lawrence Taylor and those guys, they never put a glove on him because we would keep those linebackers off of him. And I think he got confidence in the fact that he had two guys that he could trust to watch his back and watch his front. And so guys never got close to him, and that's why he was able to complete so many passes. And at the same time, the linemen were ferocious up front and blocking people and giving us just a crack that we could get through, and we gained a lot of yards just being around them.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about that. I mean, you had Jeff Van Note, Mike Ken. I think Mike Ken should be in the Hall of Fame.
No question.
You want to talk a little bit about those guys, especially Mike Ken, because he's a guy that doesn't get recognized a whole lot, and he should, because I think he's one of the greatest offensive linemen to ever play the game.
Well, you know, I love my linemen. I mean, they were the best thing. That was the best part of me, my linemen. And I respected those guys like nobody's business. Mike Kinn, I saw with Mike. Mike was 6'7", about 245 pounds, but he was rock solid in his assignment and his blocking skills and all like this. And I've never seen a guy get around him to get to Barkowski because he always had great technique. And the thing about him is that the one thing about, and I'll go back to my linemen, the one thing that I it's in disarray right now is the people that are choosing these guys to go in the hall, they don't know about us. They don't know about us because these kids are younger than way younger than you guys are. So how are they going to change?
And the thing is this, though, William, the thing that makes me mad is this. But yet they're going to nominate Paul Tagliabue and Jerry Jones. The only thing Jerry Jones ever did was ruin one of the best dynasties in NFL history, and they're only going to allow one senior player in, Kenny Easley. I mean, why not allow three players in and ignore, you know, the self-serving NFL crap?
I agree with you 100%. You know, what did an owner do other than own us? I mean, he never got a jock strap. He never put a jock strap on. He never strapped on a pair of shoulder pads. He never had to go through two a day. He never did anything like that. I understand owners are owners, but they can't be qualified to us in terms of being in a Hall of Fame based on what they did. And all you did was own it. You didn't do anything other than but make the decision. You fired, or you hired, or you cut, or are you playing? That's basically it. But I digress.
Yeah, and the thing about Jerry Jones is his biggest accomplishment is a $1 billion stadium that the taxpayers had to pay half of.
Well, you know, hey, I tell you, they get smarter and smarter every day.
Well, they just get crookeder every day, William.
Well, look, you said it. You said it. I didn't say that. But I tell you, it's upsetting to me because when you look at guys that have been in the hall. Now, take me for example, right? I won't be considered for the hall because guess what? They loop me in with the running backs and everybody else. But if you look at the last fullback they inducted in the Hall of Fame was Larry Zonka.
Yeah.
Larry Zonka was the last fullback. Now, he was a true fullback like I was a true fullback. I wasn't no running back. I wasn't no tailback. I was a fullback. But do you think they would look at any of the things I did as a fullback in order to consider me for the hall? No, because guess what? I'm a running back, so I am looped in with all those guys. But if you look at my career, I put up numbers like tailbacks, and I was a fullback. So there won't be another fullback inducted into the Hall of Fame because they looped everybody together. I am a true fullback. I've never been a tailback.
Yeah, and what they'll do is their cop-out will be, well, they only really had four good years. But in those 4 years,
I didn't ruin anybody in 4 years.
I mean, they're pulling the same stuff with Terrell Davis, who had two outstanding Super Bowl games, including an MVP.
I know. But see, that's the politics behind it, though. See? These young kids don't, everybody talk about beast mode. Well, like I look at my young friend that was out in Seattle, the running back. I can't call his name right now. No, not Kurt Warner. The present running back that just retired. What was his name? I can't think.
Oh, Marshawn Lynch.
Marshawn Lynch. They talk about. Oh, he's in beast mode. I said, y'all ain't seen no beast. I said, no. No, you got to go back in my ear and watch the beast. I said, you kids don't understand what beast mode is. So they kind of get upset at me when I say that. I said, but look, I got film. I can show it to you. You know, it's right there for you to see, but nobody's going to the archives because they like to see flashy, the towels wearing down the side, gloves on, all this kind of stuff, no blood on your jersey, none of that. No, we got it and mixed it up. Now, so look, let me go back to my lineman for a second. Mike Kinn, I already talked about him, but I look at R.C. Tillman. R.C. Tillman, one of the best guards that I have ever played with. Now, R.C., they cut R.C. from Atlanta. R.C. went to the Redskins and got a Super Bowl ring. I mean, go figure. If he was good enough to play for the Hawks, he ought to be good enough to play for the Falcons. But he got a Super Bowl ring, and I'm so happy for him. Now, I look at, you go back and take a look at Jeff Van Noe. Jeff Van Noe should be in the Hall of Fame. Here's a guy that played over 18 years. That's like George Blanda. George was in there 18 and a half years, and guess what? He went to the Hall. Van Noe didn't go to the Hall of Fame. He should have, because he got the numbers and the years, just the years alone he should be in there. So I jumped from Van Noe, which he had all the skills because he made all the calls. Then I jump over to Dave Scott, one of the best pass blockers and rushers that I've ever ran behind. Boom, we used to call him Boomer. And, boy, let me tell you something. The reason we call him Boomer is because he had a big old head. Not as big as Dave Butts, but his head was pretty dang big. And when Boomer put that hat on you, boy, you moving backwards, I'm telling you. You are going to move backwards. So Boomer was a great blocker and a great pass, defender. Now, then I'll go to Warren Bryant. Warren Bryant, 6'7", about 285. And I tell you, we call him the human forklift. When he wanted to move you, you couldn't stop him from moving you. He could move you. And so all of those guys played a part in developing me. They helped develop me. They helped to define who I was. They helped to define me as a true fullback and a running back that was in that time frame in the NFL. And then I go to Jim Mitchell, which taught me all the wisdom that I presently have about how the game ought to be played, the kind of blocks that you do, if you want to roll a guy up, if you want to cut block, all this guy. He taught me all of that, right? So when you look at from an overall standpoint of the linemen themselves, every one of them deserve every yard I've ever gotten because they were right there in front of me.
Well, you know, another one of your teammates that I want to ask you about, you know, you and Lynn Cain formed one of the best running back tandems in the early 80s.
Oh, that's my buddy. That's my buddy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you guys were one heck of a 1-2 punch. What was it like? What kind of a teammate was he like? And just tell us a little bit about your time with him.
Now let me give you a setup, right? Lynn came from California, played at USC. But he blocked for
Charlie White.
Who was the Heisman Trophy winner?
Yeah, Charlie White.
Yeah, okay. He blocked for him, right? So Lynn was a fullback. I was a fullback. I blocked for Joe Cribb, James Brooks. When we both got to Atlanta, Lynn weighed about 187 pounds, and I was pushing about 203. And I came in as a tailback fullback. Lynn was a true fullback, but they moved in the tailback, and they moved me to fullback because when they saw my blocking skills when I got there, they said, we got to switch this up. Lynn, you're a tail. William, you're a fullback. And so we developed a reading whenever we got up. I said, now, Lynn, whatever you do, you watch my hat. Whatever side my hat goes to, you go to opposite side because I got him walled off from that side. You don't have to worry about it. He's walled off when I hit him. If I hit him straight up, it's a toss-up. But if I hit him on the right side, you know you got to go right side. If I hit him on the left side, you know you got to go left side. Because remember now, he's got to come through you if you hit him on the left side. If you hit him on the right side, he's got to come through you. But you got him walled, so that's how we were able to do our blocks. And we talked to each other even before the play got started, and that we were so well in tune that if some of the pitches that we take, then when we come out of our stance, we're in perfect harmony and perfect sequence that you can't even tell who's getting the ball. That's just how good we were. And so having Lynn compliment me and me compliment him, oh, man, it was a wonder. And I hated when he went down.
Yeah, and you talked about that backfield. You guys also had Steve Bartkowski, who's a guy a lot of people, younger people, don't know about. You want to tell people or describe him to people that may never have saw him play and what was so special about him?
Bart was a wonder, let me tell you. I mean, I know he got injured around before I got there in terms of his knees and all that kind of stuff, but this guy had an arm like nobody's I've ever seen. and he had so much touch on the ball. That's what that most quarterbacks today don't have touch on the ball. They either gonna zip it or they're gonna float it. This guy had he know when to zip it and he know when to float it and he knows when to put air on it when the guys need to go get it. This guy could throw from goalpost to goalpost, and I tell you, I've never seen anything with effortlessly. He could throw it from goalpost to goalpost. I've never seen anything like that before in my life. And, you know, Bart was a heck of a baseball player, too. So when I watched this guy in practice just out there just throwing and then me on the receiving end of catching his ball, it was just like catching a powder puff. That's how soft it was when it hit your hand. And then if you had to zip it, you know what you had to do to make your arms do like shock absorbers, catch it and let it ride all the way in. So we understood all of his rhythms and that kind of thing. But, you know, and a lot of guys put him down, but he's one of the best quarterbacks I've ever played against. And I've seen Joe Theismann. I've seen Jaworski. I've seen Dan Fowle. I've seen all these guys. I've seen even Joe Montana. Steve Markowski had the best throwing arm and the best touch on the ball I've ever seen. Now, the other one that's probably a little better than him was Doug Williams.
Yeah, from Grambling.
Yeah.
Playing with the Buccaneers back then. I have never
seen him throw a ball that was wobbling. All of his balls were darts, and they were perfect spirals. Never seen it. Even when he was falling, they were a perfect spiral.
Well, tell us a little bit about. You've definitely told us a lot about your teammates, and we know, you know, the kind of talent that you played with. What were some of your proudest memories, and from your pro career?
Well, I think one of the proudest memories was when we won the Western Division that year, and we dedicated ourselves to that we were going to get it right this time, and we did. The greatest camaraderie of any group I've ever played against, and to this day, we all stay in touch with most of the guys that we played with, and we see most of the guys that we played with. And so, you know, I look at Joel Williams, I look at Al Richardson, I look at Buddy Curry, I look at Robert Pennywell, I look at Fulton Kackendall, I look at the guys that played in the interior line on defense, Jeff Merrill, Don Smith, and also Jeff Yates. All these guys had a almost like a second sense of seeing where the play developed and seeing how they could stop it, and on offense the same way, seeing what they could do to move this guy right or left and that kind of thing. So I think the proudest moment of mine is when we won the Western Division. And, I mean, we did it with all odds against us, and it was just a wonderful time for me. And I think when I look back on it, I still think that's one of the most proudest moments of my life is when we won the Western Division.
All right, so we talked that your career basically ended on an injury. How hard was it to transition into, I guess, what you would say is normal life after being an NFL player and having taken away, I mean, what you dreamed about as a kid, you were doing it, and to have it taken away through something that you couldn't help at all, was it hard to transition?
It was momentarily, but I tell you, you surround yourself with family and a friend, and, you know, you really find that it's okay. There are a lot of guys that can't get out of the sports arena and do anything else. I was fortunate enough that I had enough going for me that I could see further than the football field. I had other things I needed to do. I went back and got my degree at Auburn, and I don't use the degree, but it has helped me look at other things that I can do in life, because I didn't just pattern myself just because I was in education. I had to do education. But I think when you look at it overall, my life is great. I've got 12 grandkids. I've got three beautiful, I mean, I got five beautiful sons and one daughter, and they are just a dream to me just to have around, because I get a chance to interact with most of them, and most of the, my grandkids, I get to interact with most of them. And so, you know, that's my legacy, and that's my joy.
All right, real quick, I got a question for you.
Okay.
And I'm interrupting Matt. Matt can ask a question after. But you got 12 grandchildren, 5 kids. How do you afford
right.
Christmas?
Well, I don't. I don't.
I was kind of wondering the same thing.
It's called shopping early.
Maybe just rotate the kids, like one gets a present every 4 years.
No, what you do is you line up all your appearances about that time. So you know you're going to get paid, and that take care of your Christmases.
Yeah, but Matt can't line up any appearances. Nobody will
you know
money.
It, man. You know it. Hey, look. Now, you know, I've been bumped upside the head a bunch of times, but not that much. Yeah, you know, you set your appearances close to Christmas, and you go out and do your speaking engagement. You get paid, and all that you get paid, right? You turn that over to the wife, and she takes care of Christmas for it. So that's the scheme, you know. Come on, man. It's just like running a well diagram play. Okay, I want you to run 10 yards and square out, and by the time you turn your head around, the ball will be there. So that's how it's set up.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, the Atlanta Falcons are headed back to the Super Bowl for the second time in franchise history, and just wanted to know what you think of the current team and what your prediction is for Sunday's game.
Well, my current take on the team right now is that they got a good football team. They really do, and I think start from Matt Ryan. I didn't know Matt. I met him. I guess it's been about a month ago. I've met him at a Man of the Year award that the Falcons had. They was invited all the Man of the Year guys back. And I went up to him and I said, you know what? This is my first time ever meeting you, man. I never talked to you. And because I didn't talk to you, I didn't like you like that. So he said, he said, well, Mr. Andrews, I'm glad we had a chance to meet, because I like for you to like me. And so ever since then, I got a lot of respect for him. The kid is a fantastic player. I see his limitations, and I also see his strength. And that's what's so good about him. He knows his limitations, but he also knows his strength. So if you give him an opportunity, he will hurt you with the short pass. And that's what his motto is, if I can do it. And it reminds me of Joe Montana. Joe Montana never threw long balls unless he had to. But if he had to pick you off the Bill Walsh offense, I need 6-7 yards here, 6-7 yards. Not like Joe Gibbs with Washington Redskins, 6-7 yards here, there, and then you do what you need to do, because he had wide receivers that could make you miss and all that kind of stuff. But I look at these kids now. I look at Freeman and all these guys that own offense that really has their skills. I look at Julio Jones. This kid, he's a wonder. He really is. Not a big guy, tall, very well built. He's set in a statue, and this kid can really go and flat get it. Now, but there's always a but. So let me put the but in. The first one that makes a mistake, that normally going to be the tall tale signs of who will win and who will lose. And I look at New England. Belichick and his organization, Mr. Kraft, and what he's done with that organization out there. I played against New England way back in the day. They've always been good. They've never had what I call just desperation season. They these guys were tough to beat. And the Falcons are tough to beat. Here's the difference, though. I think New England's defense is a lot sounder than ours, but ours is coming along. So I think with enthusiasm and the right plays of breaking up passes and recovering fumbles or making a hit, that will turn the game in Atlanta's favor, because of the fact that they've never been there before, not with these kids. These kids are hungry. And so I think that's going to be the difference.
All right. But at least you're not biased in your prediction either, so.
Well, not really. Not really. I'm a hometown boy, so I'm gonna be, you know, I'm gonna be for Atlanta.
So what occupies your time? What keeps you busy today?
Well, I presently have a transportation business, so that keeps me busy and keeps me going. So I'm happy. Got a lovely wife, Gladys. She's been ace in my corner for 17, 18 years now, and I got to tell you, I love being around her.
All right, so my last question, what do you think of the quality of play in the NFL today compared to the 60s, 70s, 80s?
Well, and I may get in trouble for this, but I'm going to say it. I'm big enough. I'm big enough. I got bodyguards and all that kind of stuff around me, so I'm good. You know, I think the kids today are fundamentally well-built, right? They were aware of their physique and everything, but they're not in hitting shape. There's a difference. There's a difference in being in hitting shape and a difference in just having the physique and in shape to run around and do all this. See, the one thing that they don't understand, the muscles have to get used to being hit. And that's why we've seen a lot more injuries than we've seen in past years that we played, because the more you hit, and the more you condition those muscles to take those shots, they're less likely to get hurt. I mean, you can go back and look at teams after teams after teams, and you see you got key players get hurt in today's setup, and that just throws you all off kilter. So I think the kids are in great physical shape, but they're not in hitting shape, and there's a difference.
Yeah, but the problem is with the CTE problem and everything, I mean, I can understand why they don't hit as much. I mean, do you think it should still be the way it was, or do you think that it is better this way just to keep everybody safer, possibly?
But I mean, okay, I look at the CTE. I got that, okay? The owners knew about this a long time ago, okay?
Yeah.
And the fact that they knew about it, they really don't want to help us guys that have gone through concussions and all that kind of stuff. I understand that. But it's a money thing for them. But the thing of it is that these guys got insurance on each one of the guys that ever played in this thing, and you are looked at based on the number of years that you play in the sport. Like running back is 3.5 years. If you go past 3.5 years, that's gravy to them, because guess what? They don't have to pay the premium, right? Linebackers, quarterbacks, all that, everybody's got a grade they under, right? But here's the thing. Here's the thing. You have to look at it from a standpoint of teaching kids the fundamentals of blocking, tackling, and catching the ball. That's the fundamental. They're getting away from that. You can butt off with head up and that kind of thing, and that's all technique. But when you get in a live situation in a game against somebody else and you don't know how to properly place your head or that, you're going to get injured. If something's going to happen to you, I can tell you. But if you're fundamentally sound in your technique, you're most less likely to get hurt than the situation that these kids got now.
All right, Matt, you got any final question for William?
Well, you pretty much answered most of it when you talked about concussions and things like that. And, with insurance and, you kind of touched on, we've had a lot of players that we've heard from over the years and talk about, the treatment of the players that really made this game great, and that how most of the younger players are making a lot of money off of what the older players built. And it's a shame to see what a lot of the retired players are going through. And what's your opinion on how retired players are treated?
Well, I don't think we are treated with the respect that we're due, because when you look at it, we helped make the game just like the guys before that came before me. We helped make the game who it was, like the guys before me. They helped make the game possible for me. We made the game possible for the kids that are in it now. And the fact that the owners see the difference in what it was and what it is now, everybody is trying to be prima donnas and this and that, and they really think that they walk on air and they're above everybody else and above the law and all this kind of stuff. But you're not. There are things fundamentally that you have to realize. There's a certain thing that we call law and order, even in football. You have to abide by the rules that are set. Now, if you're not willing to do that, then that game is going to pass you by real quickly. But we have paid our dues. We've paid our dues. We deserve the respect from the younger players and from fans that knew about who we were and that kind of thing. We've earned that. We've earned that respect. We're not asking you to give us anything we haven't earned, but whatever we've earned, give it to us. And quit playing around with all of these lawsuits and appeals and all this kind of stuff. There are guys out here that are really hurting. And these owners could give a rat's behind whether they family is doing with or doing without.
Yeah,
in,
Roger
in
Goodell's making $40 million a year.
And doing what?
Right.
Sitting on his ass? Come on, give me a break.
Yeah, sitting on his ass and waiting till people bitch so much that it forces him to do something.
Give me a break, man. Come on. That's just
it's ridiculous.
I mean, it's just like turning flapjacks, man. Shit, you're either good on one side or you're not on the other side. So, I don't want to get on the soapbox with that, but there are guys out here that are really hurting. And the NFL owe it to those guys because of the success that they have made the NFL today, they made the success that they are. They never would have got to the spot that they were if they didn't have us guys and guys before me set them on a pedestal where everybody looks at them.
Yeah, and the thing is this. We've had three or four guys that were all on the all-decade team in the 60s that have been on the show that I've talked to them off air after the interview, and they'll tell me that their pension, and these are guys that played for more than a decade, their pension's like $1,000, $1,200 a month.
Yeah, man, look, look, depending on how long you play, it's probably worse than that for some.
Yeah.
But the thing I'm saying is the owners, they owe us. And if they don't do it the right way, they're going to lose a lot. I'm telling you. They're going to lose a lot. But, you know, time has a way of catching up with you.
Yeah.
Time has a way of catching up with you. And if you don't treat them right, time is going to show you how bad it's going to be for those guys. Now, yeah, they billionaires. They can go and relax and do all the things they want to do based on not having the football. But what is football taking away?
Yeah.
Then owners got no more entertainment.
But, see, I think a lot of the problem there are the current players, the players that played in the 90s, all these guys that could have made a stand and ended up not doing it because they think when they're 25 years old that they're invincible and they're always going to play football.
Well, and see, that's the sad story, right? Because the NFL, the guy used to say, that means not for long.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
I think it was Jerry Glanville that used to say that, wasn't it?
Right.
Not for long. And truly, it's not for long. I mean, you're in it for a spot, and then barring injury or anything like that, and then barring, you know, with the help of the good Lord, that you can stay in as long as my friend Van Note and George Blandon and those guys stayed in for as long as they did. That was nothing but the good Lord watching them and protecting them through that whole thing. Now, they had bumps and bruises. They missed a few games and that kind of thing. But for the most part, when they get out of it, you know, I look at Jim Ott. Man, boy, he was in terrible. I mean, they just beat him up. I look at Joe Namath. I look at Johnny Unitas. All those guys were beat up to no end when they got out. I even look at Deacon Jones and those guys. Those guys
Earl Campbell.
Well, that's what I'm saying, Earl and Saint.
Campbell,
I mean, it's crazy. But you know, like I say, I got respect, mad respect for all of those guys because they helped me fulfill the dream that I've always had, the opportunity to play in the NFL and to show how much talent I had and to show that I had just as much talent as the next guy that cared the football. So don't get it twisted. You know, you're only as good as your next play.
Yeah.
And if you're not as good as your next play, guess what? You're on the road.
But, hey, William, it was an absolute honor to have you on the show tonight.
Well, my pleasure, man. Anytime you need me, you got my number.
Yep. Yeah, I'll be using it too. That's okay, you know.
Well,
you know where Mike Ken is, by the way?
Mike Ken?
Yeah.
I can let me see if I can email him and see if he take your call and you guys get on the line and talk with him. Because
right.
I know he'd love to talk to you guys.
Yeah, I'd love to have him on. Like I said,
you would love that.
When we first started doing this show, it was to get guys like you on to tell their story to younger people that don't know why this sport has become what it has become. And, I mean, Robert Brazil, Mike Ken, guys like that were guys I wanted to have on. I had most of them, but we're still missing Mike Ken. So,
well, Mike would be a great one to talk to because he really is the epitome of offensive tackle that played on left side, that nobody overpowered him, being as small as he was, 245. Come on, man.
Yeah.
You guys don't wear no 245 anymore.
I'm 245 now as a wide receiver if you're 6'7".
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, come on, man. They don't have guys like that lean and that can hold those guys that outweigh him by 40 pounds. Uh-uh.
Well, and he was great with the kick step, and that's something that you watch guys in the NFL now, half the tackles can't even kick step correctly.
That's true.
And, I mean, a lot of that's fundamentals just because of all the spread offense and everything they run in college.
It all goes back to fundamentals. They're not teaching fundamentals. They are just not doing it. Just because you can run and catch and do all this, you still got to defend.
Yeah. But, all right, William, once again, it was an honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, my friend.
And we've got one of your old teammates is going to be on with me tomorrow, Greg Brazina from the Atlanta Falcons, who part of that 1977 Grits Blitz.
You're going to
up 9 points a game.
You're gonna have some fun with Greg because, I mean, he can tell you where all the skeletons are.
He knows where all the bodies were buried, huh?
Yeah, I'm glad to tell you, man. He knows where all the skeletons lost their skin.
We'll do this. We'll leave you out of the conversation.
Believe you me, he knows where all the skin that came off those skeletons. That's it.
All right. Thanks, William.
Hi, my friend.
Any final words? You there, Matt?
I thought you said William. I'm sorry. Yep. My bad. I'm sorry about that. I thought you said William. William, again, I want to just reiterate what Mike said. It was an absolute honor to talk to you. One of my favorite players. And, just thanks for all the time you gave us and all the great stories and insights into your playing days.
Well, you know, I do appreciate it. And we need a lot more guys like you guys that are actually showcasing us and talking to these young kids about the fundamentals of the game and not looking at the game as, a profit in terms of whether you can do it just all your life because it's not going to happen. It's not in the cards. It's not in the cards.
But, all right, thanks a lot, William. I would remind our listeners that you can check out our Inside Boxing Weekly show later tonight. We had former light welterweight champion of the world, Lamont Peterson, on, current bantamweight champion, Rasheen Warren was on. Also Barry Hunter, who's the trainer for Peterson and Warren. Also check out our NFL Pick'em show tomorrow night, which, William, if you want to be on, you're more than welcome. We're going to have Gary Burley, former teammate of William. He also played with the Bengals. We'll have Mark Cooper from the Denver Broncos in the 80s, offensive lineman, and Luis Sharp, who was a Pro Bowl offensive lineman for the Cardinals. We're going to break down the Super Bowl. So, William, if you want to come on tomorrow night, you can come on with us for that, too.
No, I appreciate it. I'm going to leave it to the experts. Both guys.
Well, we get experts.
You're leaving it to them. They're the experts. Them linemen know what they're doing, man. Trust me. I was just glad to be drug along, you know what I mean?
All right, guys, make sure you check out Gridiron Mo, our main sponsor at www.gridironmo.com. You can hear all our shows on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, Google Music. Wherever you find podcasts, you'll find the grueling truth. So for Matt Andrews Scavage, William Andrews, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.